Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now, for some, a conventional history of African American cinema in the 20th century could perhaps begin with Emmett J. Scott's three-hour epic The Birth of a Race in 1918, and then take in the films of Oscar Michaud, linger around blaxploitation in the 1970s, and then survey a 90s popular new wave comprising films by Spike Lee, the Hughes Brothers, and John Singleton. But in Los Angeles from the late 1960s through to the 90s, a number of filmmakers emerged from the University of California's School of Theatre, Film and Television. Although not a formally convened group with a strict manifesto, the filmmakers who have latterly been identified as the LA Rebellion shared a commitment to creating a new kind of black cinema, independent of both the commercial pressures and reductive narrative tropes of Hollywood pictures. Running the gamut from surrealistic jazz-propelled fiction and political biography to beautifully poetic and naturalistic portrayals of working-class African-American life, the LA Rebellion's depiction of Los Angeles offers a cogent alternative to the high-concept and high-gloss pop culture renderings of the City of Angels. Over the past few weeks, Tate Modern has been host to a major retrospective survey of the movement, screening films from directors like Charles Burnett, Haile Gerima, Julie Dash and more. Here's curator of film at Tate, George Clark, to tell you more about it.
The LA Rebellion Film Program is like a product of many people's activities over many years. So firstly, the term LA Rebellion was coined by Clyde Taylor, who's a cultural critic, when he organized one of the first retrospectives of the group of filmmakers and work produced at UCLA in the late 60s, 70s. That was organized at the Whitney Museum of American Art in 1986. And he came up with this label that kind of superseded and now has become the dominant to describe the work kind of produced by this kind of exceptional kind of group of students and subsequent generations. Prior to that is also called the Los Angeles School of Black Filmmakers, and different labels have kind of floated around. The program that we did here really was a product of the recent research and restoration project at UCLA, at the Film and Television Archive there, where, as part of their participation in Pacific Standard Time, citywide exhibition research project, they decided to look at this generation of filmmakers and to really bring that work back into circulation, both through kind of research, intensive research program, but also an intensive restoration program, in acknowledgement of the increasing importance of some of these films, but also the fact that they were slipping from histories of independent film, experimental film, if they were even there in the first place. So really our program here was an attempt was to bring these works, the kind of restored works and the kind of reclaimed works, to UK audience. But in some ways, one of the key ambitions was also to situate that within this history of dialogue and discussion about this group of particular filmmakers, but also the kind of legacy of the debates around what black cinema could be and how that was impacted and picked up by generations of practitioners internationally, particularly, you know, in the UK and the exchanges that took place through early screenings of these films and, you know, kind of invitation of many filmmakers such as John Acomfrey or Isaac Julian, who had a kind of direct dialogue and response to many of these works. So, you know, the ambition was to bring these films here, but also to try and present them in a slightly different way to what happened at UCLA, where, as a kind of archival imperative there, you know, they did an incredible job to preserve and to tell the kind of full history and follow all the trajectories of the kind of key works made by all these students. So they followed that through from very early works up to late works. In some ways, in presenting it here at Tate Modern and within the context of a museum, you know, our ambition was to try and change the argument a little bit to look at the context that the work came out of, the political context, and also the kind of parallel discussions and work within the visual arts, within performance, within music, that kind of coloured a lot of that work and kind of really informed both the work kind of aesthetically, but also in the terms of how it's made. But many of the films came out of engagement, collaborative methods of working, and also engagement, direct engagement with community through the legacy of community activists and kind of educational projects within South Los Angeles and within African American communities, that they tried to create a link to bring the opportunities opened up at UCLA back into the community and into generations who maybe couldn't participate.
When did you first hear about the LA Rebellion group?
So when I was in, I was living in Los Angeles prior to working at Tate, and was very fortunate to be there in the midst of like the emergence of this research project. So just one of the first pieces I wrote about my time in Los Angeles was based on this essay film by Tom Anderson called Los Angeles Plays Itself. There's also one of the key agents of the rediscovery of this period, because it ends, kind of famously ends, with this declaration of a kind of emergence of what Tom Anderson talks about as a neorealist cinema, which is a cinema of walking, kind of, rather than a cinema of the freeways that kind of dominates Los Angeles. And the kind of three key works that he designates and kind of ends the film on are Bush Mama by Haile Gerima, Killer of Sheep by Charles Burnett, and Bless Their Little Hearts by Billy Woodbury. And in some ways that film also kind of helped position this work as central to understanding of Los Angeles and how it could be depicted. And that kind of started this project to kind of reclaim and restore various of these works. And so I was in LA at the same time when these like rumblings of these restorations were happening.
The LA Rebellion program here at Tate has been really, really ambitious. It must have been some feat to bring it to fruition. How are you feeling now that you're sitting the other side of it?
Yeah, great. A little, you know, I like missing it already. You know, missing the people who kind of came, the kind of engagement, you know, the level of engagement that's really been kind of remarkable. And yeah, I'm feeling sort of pressure now, like what next? You know, because it took a long time. You know, this is a project that kind of came out of kind of time and experiences prior to Tate, and it was one of the first projects I wanted to do here, but took about 2 years to bring it together. But, you know, I think what all the projects, hopefully they should all be kind of a provocation or a proposal and the beginning of a conversation. I kind of really don't like the kind of, there's kind of certain tendency of retrospectives or festival or exhibitions that are kind of almost a wake. So this is the time when you get to see all this work, but it's also the end. It's kind of a funeral for this figure. So in some ways, hopefully, the kind of proposal and the kind of emphasis on these diverse kind of strands and ways that these artists continue to work in the context, hopefully that's something that's going to get picked up, debated, argued about, and kind of find other sort of connections elsewhere.
That was George Clark there, curator of film at Tate Modern. Now, at the start of the LA Rebellion film season, I caught up with filmmakers Barbara McCullough and Billy Woodbury to find out more about the UCLA School of Theatre, Film and Television.
So, I mean, you both arrived at UCLA later on in the 1970s. Barbara, what was it that drew you to the School of Theatre, Film and Television there?
Okay, I had taken an undergraduate course that was a community access course. But the two professors, one was an anthropologist and the other one was a documentary filmmaker. And they had this trailer in Topanga Canyon. And basically the course was met in Topanga and you were supposed to shoot some aspect of life in Topanga Canyon. So I found this experimental filmmaker from New York who was doing hand-painted films, but unfortunately he had gotten poison ivy in his eyes, so he couldn't really function. But then he had a very young wife who was pregnant. And so I basically just hung out with them for a little while and shot. And the professor who was the film professor liked, you know, what he saw in terms of, you know, what I had done. He liked my eyes, so he said if I was interested, he would give me a letter of recommendation. But before that, though, I was interested in photography, and I was interested in video, and I wanted to be the Zora Neale Hurston of the 20th century.
And what about you, Billy?
All right, so what happened? I sort of slowly, in the summer, one summer between finishing the bachelor's degree and going to graduate school. I spent the summer at my college at Cal State Los Angeles because I was applying to graduate schools far and wide, and I was waiting to hear, or I was hearing results that I didn't prefer. I simply wanted to do like African studies and then do a course in African history or something like that. And so that didn't work. But while I was waiting, I decided to take some courses in Latin American studies because it was known that the professors in that program were progressive people, were really smart people, and were politically sympathetic to where I was coming from. And my friends had studied with them in political science, in history, and in anthropology. So they had a summer course because they themselves had become excited and interested by what was happening in cinema in Latin America. And one of their colleagues who taught for years, he was a historian, E. Bradford Burns, he taught at UCLA, and he sort of made a course, Latin America through cinema. And it was just a chance to, what do you call it, excite students and excite people in the field with a new medium of expression and communication that seemed to carry a lot of the history and the political issues and social issues. It was present in the films, and the cultural, you know, aspects were present in the films. So I think in the field, because they were close to him, they were friends, they were colleagues, they started their own sort of thinking about this. And they made a course about Cuba, and it was Cuba through cinema, Cuba through the Cuban revolutionary process, through the films that they made about the process. And we saw films about the campaign to fight illiteracy, where all the young people went to the countryside and they were teaching these older people how to read and write and the alphabet and next kind of thing. And I didn't realize at the time that a film could be so interesting, and at the same time it could be instructional or educational or whatever, but it wouldn't lose the excitement of what they were doing. So after that, I sort of professed my interest to friends, and they sort of encouraged me with that. And through these professors, I met a Brazilian guy, Mario da Silva, who was in his next to last year. He was in his last year in the MFA program. And he's the first guy to bring me to UCLA. And they gave me good letters of recommendation. And, you know, I sort of timidly submitted the work and submitted the application. And I was accepted, you know.
Barbara, what was the atmosphere like at UCLA when you got there?
It was exciting, intimidating, and people were moving on who had been there for a while. You know, Billy was still there, thank goodness. But most people had, you know, were pretty much on their way out the door, okay? Now, I would be visiting the films, the film school, Melnitz Hall, actually, okay? Mm-hmm. Periodically anyway, because I was taking one or two classes in third world cinema, okay? And so that was how I was like going over there, and I knew of people, you know, I knew of Haile, and I knew of Charles, you know, and I knew of other people. And by the time, you know, like I got there, like I said, they were like leaving, you would see people, but they were not like fully engaged in, you know, in classes or anything like that. I mean, Charles, I think, was still working on his film. And, but when I got there, you know, the same year that I entered, it was Julie Dash, Carol Parrott Blue, Alilia Sharon Larkin was already there, Ofumalayo Makara was already there, you know, I think Stormy Bright might have been there, and there were a couple other women, I can't think of their names right now, but they were there, Alicia Danifu was there, And so you had this influx of women coming in where the men were exiting, okay? So it sort of like left a kind of like hole, because the experience that they had, you know, in terms of working their way, not through the, you know, the college system, you know, through Melnitz Hall, the classes and whatever, so that knowledge was like lacking, so you kind of felt like you're on your own. So we were like commiserating, you know, and at the same time, when people were starting to do projects, I mean, the best way to learn is to basically be involved in someone's project, because, you know, you're pretty much left on your own. You know, when you started the film school, you were left on your own. So it was good in one way, because you could propose whatever project you wanted to, and, you know, you were just told go for it. But at the same time, you know, call it sort of a system of benign neglect, because you were maybe somewhat too much on your own. You were kind of lost, you know. And so, I mean, I can remember, you know, one person, you know, she was just very, she was taking a cinematography class, and she, you know, she really, I think, thought she was going to get a major mind dump from the professor, and that just didn't exist, you know. So she was extremely frustrated. It was all really about you're getting your experience by doing the work and working with other people. So that's why I say there was like the good part of it and there was the bad part of it. You know, like when we went to UCLA, and this is an observation someone made later on, we had an experience of various different levels of film production. So we were not assigned, you are a director, you do this. You're a cinematographer, you do this. You're a writer, you do this. So you have the opportunity to take all these classes, okay, required, and some others, like you could take these electives. But the point I'm making is people at SC, they were like pigeonholed into certain areas, and that's what they did. So I felt like we were, you know, because of the way the program was structured, we got a well-rounded experience of, you know, filmmaking or video making. And so that was the benefit, but also too, it was very disconcerting, because you were, you know, you're trying to figure out what to do, you know, like, you know, where am I going to go with this, you know?
Can I get a bit more of a sense of the core structure? Because it's something that happened in the past and happened overseas, when you read texts about it, it's people talk about, yeah, the School of Theatre, Film and Television. Mm-hmm. But what did that actually mean? Was it an MFA structure?
Oh, yes. Yeah, mine was the MFA.
And what if I was a student coming to that school doing an MFA, what would my course be? What was it, a year? Was it 2 years?
Well, that's what's really interesting what you're saying, because when I left, it was like, I think three, what is it? Oh, it was like 10 quarters was the maximum, I think, by the time I left. When I got there, there didn't seem to be any particular, you know, restriction on how long you could be there, because some people had been there for a very long time. I was there for a long time. Charles was there for a long time, you know. And so I, you know, got to the point where, I mean, I'd been there really a long time, you know. So I think I started like in, oh, maybe 77, 78, and by the time I graduated, it was in 84.
So what was the specific time period that you had to fulfill in order to get your qualification?
Well, you had, you know, there were certain project classes that you had to take and fulfill, but those project classes could take a long time. Okay, so you had your project, I guess, project two? I can't hardly remember. Project
one, two, and thesis. Three, and thesis.
Yeah.
Sometimes the people combined the three and the thesis, or they went from the two to the thesis. Mm-hmm. But you had required courses, like you needed to do a sequence of writing courses for the MFA. You needed to do a sequence. You needed to do editing, sound. Mm-hmm. You could do re-recording sound by the time we were there. Before, you couldn't touch those things. It was the control of the technicians, but then some of the faculty felt it was important for people to have hands-on experience with that. You did, you could do cinematography. You did cinematography. You did a sequence of cinematography, basic and advanced and intermediate or whatever. People who that was sort of, that were inclined that way, they tended to do that and be teaching assistants for the class. Mm-hmm. Then you had the possibility of making sometimes a small film, 1 minute or 3 minutes, in something called design class. But we had a curriculum. It wasn't like it was completely vague. And where most people spent their time was when they attempted to make really ambitious thesis films, unless they had financing from a grant that allowed them to complete it in a short period of time, then they sort of had to take their time and they had to make money outside. Mm-hmm. like they worked during the day and then they came there at night. So if you wanted to see that person, you met them at night because they were in the editing room until 1 or 2 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night.
I was just in the bookshop downstairs and I picked up a book on minimalism. And the first line of the book, which I've got written on my hand now, is there is a problem with minimal art. It never existed. And I think the idea is that minimal art only exists as a tag that a journalist invented to talk about a pool of artists who never saw themselves as being related to each other. But I wanted to ask you about the LA Rebellion. So the idea of LA, the term was coined by somebody, but it seemed to me that there might be a case for saying that it was a group, that you were related and that you were using similar actors and you were all working towards a specific goal. Would I be right in saying that?
Well, I think there was these relationships. You had minimal direction from faculty, okay? You relied on each other in terms of, critiques, it was a very loose, and I would have never thought of it as LA Rebellion or LA School. I never thought in those terms. I just thought of people who were like, almost like comrades in arms. Everybody working towards the same goal of getting their project done. Okay? And everyone had the idea of, creating images that are reflective of, who they were as opposed to what was, maybe imposed from the outside world. So I think that, that was the collective, thought.
I mean, it seems to me that's quite an important goal because at this time when you're making film, it's like you're making film in the shadow of decades and decades of false representations, and specifically in the shadow of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation in L.A. And then in the between the period that you guys are making work, blaxploitation film is on the rise as well. Did that make your conviction as filmmaker stronger? Did that make you know? Did it make you realize what you needed to film more succinctly than if you didn't have those things to work against or to counter?
I think, in my opinion, what happened was the people that entered the school before me and the people in the film school itself, there was a kind of thinking and criticism of the prevailing commercial cinema. In any case, some people were more, and we were sort of exposed to one privilege of being in film school, is we were exposed to cinema across the history of cinema, and most of its manifestations, right? And we were sort of aware of it, and then you could choose from that history, and also it's a university that needed to justify itself in terms of research because that's what it purports to be. So if you wanted to research the history and image of blacks in cinema, there was somebody you could probably write that paper for as an independent study. The other thing is I'm reminded that in some ways we witnessed, and though we're older, we're not that old. We witnessed the evolution of two important factors in the latter part of the 20th century in the history of cinema. The evolution of film studies, because the development of the master's and the PhD program in film history, film theory, and film, criticism at UCLA, it began a bit before we got there, and it evolved, while we were there and after we were there. Okay, the very institution that has mounted this program and has mounted the effort to preserve our work evolved from Bob Gottlieb showing and collecting Chaplin's movies and making a whole course on Chaplin that was beloved by many of the students, right? And other films and other collectors, right, were looking for a place to put their private collections. Professors used to borrow films from them. And I'm telling you, if you go and research it, Howard Suber, right, one of the principal teachers and people who helped, and Steve Mamber, who wrote the first book on direct cinema in the USA. All those people were fairly recent young teachers. Paul Schrader, he didn't study screenwriting and that at UCLA. He studied film criticism and wrote his book, his thesis about what became transcendentalism in cinema when Pauline Kael or one of them were teaching around there, right? So we saw this also accompanies what was happening in a way, right? And then in our area, I mean, in an area of special interest for us, third cinema, third world cinema, I mean, we had a club that showed those first films arriving from Africa and Latin America and Asia and all that with our classmates from across the globe, Iran, Egypt, and all those places, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to see those films in, you know, in a class, in the Negro cinema class.
It became a class. It was a class before with Eliseo Taylor. Mm-hmm. And then Tashomi, who was then completing his doctorate, mm-hmm. after a couple of master's degree, he was completing his doctorate in film theory, film history, the PhD program. He was the teacher of this course on third cinema, right? And wrote one of the first important books about it, right? So we were around all of that, and we were seeing that. Okay, so our idea, maybe, about movies and what was possible might have been, it might have been a bit more historically conscious, and we had the space and privilege to, like, think about it. And we didn't have the pressure, in a way, of trying to convince somebody in the studio that we would do exactly what they wanted to do and, you know, that kind of thing. So we had a sort of privilege of learning and trying to make something in the best way that we could with models that might have exceeded what was around. And some people definitely... I mean, it's within the films. They comment upon the images that you find in a lot of those popular commercial films, blaxploitation films that were around. They comment upon them and critique them, okay? But they're not committed to reproducing that, mm-hmm. okay? That came differently and later, right? I think one thing, not to be too, you know, pretentious or noble or whatever, but one virtue that we had at the time, in a way, I believe, is that we were really serious. I learned to be serious with these characters that I was with, but at the same time, we weren't looking to, you know, others to, like, say, oh, really, you're great, you da-da-da-da. We didn't think about that. I remember a friend said one time we were shooting, and he said, is this thing really anything good? Do you think this is something special? He's a dear friend and colleague, right? And we say, you know what? We don't know. No. But we know we're going to finish today, and then we're going to finish the next time, and we're going to finish the next time. Now, the same friend came to me and said, Billy, I remember asking you this, and in fact, and I remember telling you, why don't you just make it shorter, whatever, you can finish and you can, whatever. And he said, and you didn't listen, and I'm glad you didn't, because you were right. Not because I was right, but, you know, it was the right thing to try to do, right? So, I mean, that's, you know, that's what I remember. But I'm trying to say something specific. Mm-hmm. Film school is not what it is now. It was difficult. It was a privileged place to be, a difficult place to access. And we were lucky enough to access it in significant numbers that we weren't completely existentially lost and weird and the only one and, you know, that kind of thing. We had enough of ourselves there and other people because we had this sense that we were able to attempt things and support one another without being completely overwhelmed mm-hmm. by the process. Somebody had done it. And if you were willing, you could ask that person, mm-hmm. how do you do this and not be embarrassed?
Yeah.
Okay, and when you can do that, it's better than when you're alone and you're coming and you have, because you didn't have these things in your life, right? So you have a kind of technophobia if you didn't work with cameras and machines and devices. Somebody needs to recognize that, and without humiliating you, right, encourage you to know that it's just a machine and you can use that thing. And I think having enough of us around made us able to do that. And also having enough of us around, we weren't the oddity that the majority group could dismiss as just, you know, some weirdos who were on a special pass.
That was filmmakers Barbara McCullough and Billy Woodbury speaking there. So on the last day of Tate's film program, I went over to the auditorium to speak to filmmaker Ben Caldwell and actor and performer Roger Guinevere-Smith. I was interested to see how the context around their near 30-year history of collaborations could show how the legacy of the LA Rebellion is being preserved through performance, workshops, and community projects.
My name is Ben Caldwell, and I live in Los Angeles in the infamous neighborhood of Leimert Park, and I have a business studio there.
I'm Roger Guinevere-Smith, and I write and I perform, and I'm here with Ben Caldwell at the Tate Modern, and happy to be here in this company.
The Chaos Network is a proactive art organization that operates in a predominantly Black community, upwardly mobile Black community in Los Angeles. I chose it as a place to kind of really engage the Black community with media, especially, but to kind of really study in an ethnographic way what was up in and around our neighborhood. And it's really, I always say it has multiple tentacles. It's like 8 different tentacles, so it's kind of like an octopus. It's been able to collectively work with art, animation, film, television, community arts organizations as a mouthpiece for it, to also, what do you call it, do art and practice, also to do the politics of the neighborhood, to engage it in a way that we really act as a forefront on seeing how art can engage a neighborhood in a way that can act as a political advocate for it.
And how did you set the organization up?
Initially, I had finished teaching at Howard for about 3 years. Howard is a real phenomenal Black school in Washington, D.C. And I'm from New Mexico. So when I went to a predominantly Black college as a teacher, it really amazed me. So when I chose to come back to Los Angeles, I wanted to bring that kind of an experience to what I was doing, and also work with youth, because at the time I started it, youth, especially the Black youth, didn't have a place to be somebody. So I thought that would be a good avenue to work in. So with John Otterbridge, who's one of the people who runs the Watts Towers, we co-wrote a proposal to the state that was called the Artisan Community Grant, and that kind of helped me have the stability. I ended up, I got that grant for 8 years, and with the intent and purpose to do what I had just described, is to really engage the community. And I didn't know exactly what, but I just knew that I needed to be a filmmaker in the communities. So the way I thought of it was that I had a degree, and all my cohorts had degrees in law and also in doctoring, and they would just put their slate out and say they were open for business. And so I did the same thing. I just said I was going to have walk-in clients, see how I could engage it, and then make my specific purpose to the underprivileged, and especially the art organizations that were operating with the underprivileged, and offer up my skills that way.
And Roger, how did you meet Ben?
Ben and I were introduced in the early 1980s by a mutual friend from Washington, D.C., Robert Wisdom. And we became fast friends at the first meeting, I think, and talking about the concepts that Ben has been elucidating. I grew up actually in the neighborhood where Chaos was established, and immediately started working with Ben in what we called multimedia assaults, in which we used all kinds of forms, live percussion, DJing, film projection, live video projection, pre-recorded video projection, improvised text, pre-formed text as well. I created a character by the name of Holly Watts, which reflects exactly where Chaos is located, the epicenter between Hollywood and Watts, the two great mythologies that Los Angeles has produced. And that became my nickname, but it also became kind of a concept of where we were working geographically and culturally as well. And we created a number of pieces entitled, for example, United States of Emergency, March of Progress, Endurance, Conflict. And one piece that we did, which has kind of paved the way to where we are this evening here at the Tate Modern, was called Chaos TV. And it was done in response to the police beating of Rodney King, March 3rd, 1991. And in that piece, we improvised kind of a television broadcast dealing with emergency situations in the city. And we had a broadcast booth. We had a huge map of Los Angeles where I pointed as a kind of anchor to imagine conflagrations all over the city. And lo and behold, 1 year after, when the officers who had beaten Rodney King were acquitted of virtually all charges, Los Angeles exploded. And what we had foreseen in March of 1991 came to fruition in April and May of 1992, which leads us tonight to the piece that we are improvising, which is entitled Rodney King, in which Mr. King himself, who left this planet 3 years ago, Father's Day 2012, is interviewed in kind of a post-mortem form, an imagined interview with the late Rodney King. And Ben will be improvising camera moves as I improvise performance text live here at the Tate Modern Museum, 6 floors above the City of London.
Can I ask how you develop the language that you use when you do multimedia collaborations?
How did we? I think the thing that is a natural bed for this is our music. You know, we really, our music is improvisationally set. It operates in that manner, and we kind of use that as the bed to kind of create from in a constant sense. But the initial first ones, to me, it was also excavating a lot of Los Angeles, but also a lot of Rogers and my lives, you know. It was the best way to get at art is through your own real life styles. And so that's how we first dealt with it. And then out of that, we layered it more and then more, and then dealt with contextualizing it with the stories and the ideas that were taking place at the time, you know.
And Ben, what were your first impressions when you first met
Roger?
Raj
was at that time, I went to an underground club that was the Radiotron, and he was the MC, and so I was pretty impressed with that whole setup. And at the time, I was, like I said, ethnographically looking at things. So at the time, I had just finished a long stint in DC with studying music, and so got to interview Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and then when I moved to D.C., that was in Los Angeles, and then when I moved to D.C., I worked with a friend that was that was the blues professor, and he ran a blues program, and I engaged a lot of the blues then. But the whole thing that was fascinating to me was the whole idea of what kind of music has a Black Americans created that was similar to our counterparts in the Caribbean. So in studying the music, reggae especially, I was saying, what is a counterpart of that here in the U.S.? And so after looking at that, I started looking in D.C. real strongly, and there's a go-go movement there. Go-go is so fucking interesting. This is radio, so I can't say fucking right. But it was really, really, really interesting to see that they had this little, that little beat that they had. And you could hear it out in the streets, you know. When I would wake up in the morning, the kids were beating these little tin cans, and that rhythm pattern was just, it was DC. And then I turn on the radio, and it's like freestyle was just coming out, and that was what New York was doing. And I was like, wow, so this is interesting. And saw the kids for the first time doing breakdancing and spinning on their heads and jumping and flipping and, you know, really being extreme with our dance form. That really reminded me of the music that I used to watch kids, the parents, my parents and the people around me do, that was jitterbug. You know, it's kind of jitterbugging, that kind of flipping, turning, but it was done female and males together, but these kids were freestyling by themselves and spinning on their head. That was just too wild. So I was like, wow, so what does LA have? So once I moved out here, that was what the focus was. And then, so I started excavating that and opening up my doors and then asking the kids about what is fresh, what is all the different words that they were starting to create at that time that are a part of the American language systems now, but they were just creating it at the time. So it was just that kind of fascination that really made me stay in the community and deal with it in a way that I started then. The thing that was good about hip hop is the elemental parts. So they had, you know, business, they had breakdancing, drawing, which is a strong form for me, turntablists and, you know, and MCs and the whole element. So it was a whole group of different kinds of artists all working together, which kind of reminded me of when I first started with the LA Rebellion groups, that because I met Horace Taft Scott, and the first artist that I really got to meet there was David Hammonds and John Otterbridge, all these kinds of guys, Noel Purefoy. That whole set set the painting art part of my life together. But then also I was an animator. So with the animation, that was my leaning. And then I was just now learning the film form. So within the film form, I had Ivan Dixon was my mentor. I could call him at any time in that. And so he was one of my major mentors toward getting through what was real or not real about Hollywood. And that's the kind of soup that Chaos was born in. I also have an aunt that is on 8th Avenue. So she also introduced me to the neighborhood when I was still an undergrad at Arizona State. So she drove me through, and I got to see that strip that was as powerful at that time as any Hollywood strip. You would go down there, and it would have at Maverick's flat, it was a bunch of teenagers waiting outside, and you come up a little ways further, and there was the reggae spot, I forget the name of it, and then it was Pipe Piper, and Total Experience, and then at the Polish Auditorium, there was be some reggae people up in there, and it was like lines and lines of people, plus real flashy cars, and fine-ass Black people, you know, so it really made me fall in love with it.
And Roger, so you were emceeing in a club at the time. Because the thing is, you're quite an extraordinary performer. And I'm just wondering, like, at that time, you were emceeing, but was this idea of acting exploding in your mind as well? And was this idea of performing or developing ways of performing? And did that all sort of come together when you guys met and started to think about doing these multimedia performances?
Yeah, the collaborative ventures with Ben and our colleagues, Wesley Michael Groves and Mark Broyard and OG, the great percussionist, all, you know, afforded me an opportunity to join all of these interests. I was a kid who read the encyclopedia for fun when I was a kid, but I also enjoyed performing. I thought that I would pursue a PhD in history, but somewhere along the way I got into drama school. And I was also teaching English, but at the same time emceeing as Hollywatts. But at the same time doing Chekhov and Genet and Dickens and Shakespeare on stage. So I had multiple identities that I was balancing. I was Mr. Smith to my students in the daytime, and then I was Roger Genver Smith, you know, on stage doing my legitimate theater. And then I was Hollywatts after hours doing my rap thing. And I think 25 years ago was really the first time that all of this stuff came together when Ben and Wesley and I came out from California to La Mama off Broadway, where the late, great Miss Ellen Stewart commissioned us to do this piece called Frederick Douglass Now. And I had been working with Frederick Douglass material since I was an undergraduate. His narrative was probably one of the first serious books that I read as a youth. It was in my parents' home library. And we put it together in the same way that we put together all this work throughout the 1980s and called it Frederick Douglass Now, in which Douglass is still among us in a black leather jacket, but he's still doing those same great 19th century speeches, letters, editorials, but again with a hip-hop beat, with a reggae beat, always rhythmically informed. And Douglass is something that I continue to do. And in fact, I did it here when I was a student. I lived in Kensal Rise and I worked at the Seminole Keskade Art Center in Islington off of Caledonian Road. And I had the opportunity to do a student version of Frederick Douglass at that time. So, you know, that's a spirit with whom I've continued to live. And it's good because he lived to a ripe old age. And, you know, it's a person that I can continue to grow in and from. And, you know, the methodology that we used, I think, has always been rhythmically informed. You know, Ben talked about the great musics, you know, and I think that that has always colored the animated form of Ben's projections, his editing technique, and I think it's always influenced my narrative construction, whether it's something that's written or improvised or a combination thereof. And we've taken our cue from our great musical foremothers and forefathers, trying to really to catch up with what the great achievement has been in all of those forms. Charles Mingus grew up in Los Angeles, the great composer, bassist, band leader, theorist. And when he grew up, it was in the shadow of the Watts Towers, which is a fantastic structure created by one man over the course of 33 years, a little Italian immigrant by the name of Simon Rodia. And Mingus, when he was a boy, would bring Rodia pieces of glass, old bottles, crocusets full of old glass that Rodia would use to improvise these towers. And Mingus took his cue from Rodia in terms of creating these masterpieces from disparate pieces of refuse. And I think that that has always been a great symbol for us, these towers that were created from materials that had been completely discarded, and to create something of enduring value and beauty. And when Rodia felt that he was finished with the towers, he walked away and he never came back and he never sought out any kind of recognition, you know, or reward for what he had done. It's simply what he felt he needed to do, and it took him 33 years to do it.
And that reusing of materials is an integral part of our works, you know, because a lot to me of the refuge of America is of which even Black Americans are, you know, that we've been able to operate within that and create jazz, create blues, and create hip hop, and out of the and so a lot of my work is reusing a lot of that material and then recontextualizing it, you know? And so I think that has been the most fun about this, is because and then even when I taught at Cal Arts, that was part of what I would even do, is because my real dream is that really those phenomenal musicians were able to create a space for themselves in America that they could always create and stay ahead of the society, of the belly of the beast that we were in, to be able to create something that got outside that beast and just blew up. So I've always been dreaming of our films operating in that kind of context, because part of what so my class that I taught was the visualization of jazz visualization classes, and I would co-teach it with Wadada, who's Leo Smith, a jazz musician at the school, and we were just breaking it down. And the first steps that you get toward this, you understand that we're really on the first steps of really understanding visual imagery like they did musically. Notes. And what I mean by that is that there is a finite form of symbols. There's man, woman, child, you know, earth, air, sky, sun, water, you know, all of those are things that will eventually be written out, where you can talk about your script. Instead of it being a bunch of words, it can be done with a kind of a symbolic actions of pictures that you can better describe where you're moving with in your pictures. And so those are the kinds of things I think we're at that point in our world, because it's the condensing of all the material down to an iPad that once we can start really operating that way, I think then and only then will we start getting our swag back.
Thank you.